This is an ABC podcast.
Well, hello, David Rutledge here with the Philosopher's Zone. Welcome to the show and welcome to a conversation this week about beauty and ugliness. We're all perfectly comfortable talking about the former of those two qualities. We have no problem saying that this or that person is beautiful or attractive or good looking. Ugliness, on the other hand, is the physical feature that dare not speak its name, or at least not without a lot of polite hedging and qualification. My guest this week has been doing some fascinating work on ugliness and the way that the less attractive aspects of our appearance become medicalized and pathologized and framed as things that require therapeutic intervention, even though they might be naturally occurring biological phenomena. It's not as though having freckles or a large nose are the result of some sort of congenital abnormality. Eve St. James Aquino is a physician and postdoctoral research fellow at the Australian Centre for Health Engagement, Evidence and Values at the University of Wollongong, and he joins me now. Eve, welcome to the Philosopher's Zone.
Hi, David. Thank you so much for having me here.
I think it's interesting that there's a certain unspokenness about ugliness, almost like there's a sort of shame attached to explicitly pointing it out. Like if I'm at a social gathering and we're talking about some mutual acquaintance and I say, oh, I think that person's really ugly, that's a conversation stopper. I haven't just said something with which others might disagree. I've said something crass and socially unacceptable. It's much more objectionable than saying that I think that person is selfish or overly opinionated or morally unattractive, which is strange, I guess, when you consider that the imperative not to be ugly informs so many of our social practices, and yet openly expressing the opinion that someone is ugly seems a little taboo. Why do you think that might be?
That's a really good point, David, and I agree that it is taboo, and it does make my research difficult because the word ugliness is front and center of my research. And even the word ugliness is such an ugly word. It's hard to say. And when you hear it, it really catches your attention. Well, in a way, that's great for my research. It does invite exposure. But that is true. There is taboo in when it comes to discussing it openly. That's why we use a lot of synonyms to refer to that. That we use unattractive or unsightly or an even unhealthy looking person instead of the word ugly. And I think at this stage, we have come to a point of avoiding making those comments and even using the term ugly or ugliness. And I think that reflects our discomfort about the word, but also it reflects why we tend to hide from it, why we tend to have or uphold narrow ideals of appearance, because we're so afraid of discussing it, seeing it, and even describing it.
So we're looking at the ways in which ugliness can become pathologized and cast as something like a medical condition that requires clinical intervention. Let's get into that by talking about what happens when we try to define the boundaries of health and disease in general. Like, this is a scientific practice, but it's also a philosophical one. And when we get into the philosophy, we can see that it's problematic. There are very gray areas when we try to determine what illness and health mean, what their relationship to each other is. What are the philosophical issues here as you see them?
So before I get to the challenges and the philosophical problems when it comes to defining ugliness as a pathology, I have an interesting anecdote. I presented my research in a national conference a couple of years ago, and the title of my research or my presentation was Pathologizing Ugliness. And one of the comments I got after my presentation during the discussion was, do you have to use the word ugliness in the title and in your research? Because it is loaded with prejudice. Are you not contributing or are you not being complicit to this atmosphere of discrimination by using the term? And my response to that question and my response to your question as well, David, is I find ugliness an interesting concept on its own, and it's not just the opposite of beauty. As you said, there's so much space where we can use beauty. We don't have to qualify beauty. But when we use ugliness, we have to use the word perceived ugliness, because it means we're not the one making that judgment. We're just trying to reflect and reiterate what society is telling us. That's why I find ugliness really interesting on its own. And I find that people don't research the concept enough because it carries a lot of load, philosophical problems as well. And when we answer the question, is ugliness pathological or is it not pathological? We go back to that fundamental question in philosophy of medicine. We refer to this as one of the many line drawing problems because we want to draw a line between what is pathological and what is normal. And it's difficult. It's not as easy as one might expect. And usually there are two camps in philosophy of medicine. You have the naturalists, and their view is that disease and health concepts are facts that exist in the world. It's something that exists in your body independent of human judgment, basically, or human values. It's about deviation from a statistical norm, or it's about dysfunction. So you have an expected process, and if there's something unexpected that happens in that process, then that is pathological. The other side of the camp are normativists, and they say that disease and health concepts are normative or value-laden concepts through and through. They only exist because the society says so, because they lead to something that's not desirable, to something that's not valuable, and it wants people to change that condition. So it's not just about biological facts. It's about things that we disvalue. So when we consider a disease is because we don't like that condition.
So when we talk about the pathologization of ugliness as a particular type of medicalization that blurs this boundary between health and disease, where do we see this happening? I mean, are you thinking in particular of the cosmetic surgery industry, for example?
That's right. So the practice of pathologizing ugliness is really a good example of medicalization. And medicalization is an expansion. It's a phenomenon where a previously non-medical condition is now being considered a medical condition. And that has happened in the past. Think of bad breath or pregnancy. So before, bad breath is like a thing that occurs, but suddenly a company says that bad breath is actually a disease that needs to be treated, and they offer mouthwash. So now you have the term halitosis to refer to bad breath. Pregnancy is another example. Before, it's a normal physiological condition. It's a normal process that usually you don't really seek medical care for. It's something that can be, so when people give birth, back in the day, they do it at home with midwives. But more and more with industrialization, most pregnancies are now being taken care of by medical professionals, by experts in obstetrics and gynecology. And so people say that pregnancy has been over-medicalized or medicalized. When it comes to pathologizing ugliness, it's something that occurs in cosmetic surgery practice. It's an explicit framing of unattractive features as pathological or disease and requires treatment, usually in the form of surgery. And it's a very explicit claim. So we're not just talking about people going to surgery and saying they want to look better. Now, the practice of pathologizing ugliness says that what you have is pathological, it's a deformity, and we have to treat it.
Yeah, there's so much to talk about here that touches on philosophy and ethics, and yet ugliness and beauty are issues that the philosophy of medicine hasn't really picked up on, I believe. Why not, do you think?
That's really interesting. And in my study, I found some philosophers of medicine, like Christopher Boers. He's one of the leading, he doesn't really claim to be a naturalist, but at least a lot of his work has been referred to as a primary example of a naturalist view or naturalist position in defining disease. He has mentioned aesthetic concerns and cosmetic surgery, but usually with philosophers of medicine, they feel that the concept or problems of appearance are a bit superficial. They're quite trivial, and they don't feel that they merit serious philosophical concerns. That's one reason. So they're not, when you talk about unattractive features, it doesn't sound as serious as diabetes or mental illnesses when it comes to conceptual discussions. And then the other reason is that issues or concerns about appearance is really fall under the field of cosmetic surgery. And cosmetic surgery itself is a marginal practice in medicine. And because of that, people think whatever ethical or conceptual issues that cosmetic surgery raises, it only exists in that field. It doesn't exist for the rest of medicine, for other medical practices. And therefore, it doesn't really merit serious philosophical discussion.
Yeah, one thing I really find interesting in your work is the way that you present pathologizing ugliness as, in part, something passive that sort of almost like a default state that results from the way that we conflate health and beauty norms. And of course, it's not just passive, and we can talk about the active phenomenon in a minute. But let's stick now with this widespread notion that our physical appearance and our health are intimately connected. Can you tell me more about how that works and how it results in a sort of inevitable pathologization of ugliness?
Yes. So in my research, I've looked into a lot of cultural practices in history and even beliefs that conflate health and beauty. What that means is that we often consider them as twin concepts. What is healthy is beautiful. One way that it happens is what I refer to as the moral conflation of health and beauty. Moral conflation, it means that we ascribe some kind of moral upstandingness to a healthy state and a beautiful state. And if you deviate from that, if you're unhealthy or if you're unattractive, if you're not maintaining your appearance, it's a sort of moral failure. So this is something that Heather Widows have discussed in her book, Perfect Me or Perfect Me, talking about how we have come to believe that it is our obligation to be beautiful. And that's really coming from all the way back to ancient Greece with Socrates and Aristotle talking about beauty as an ideal. The other is more of a social-cultural conflation. It's because a lot of markers, physical markers of health, are often considered to be unattractive. So if you think about having cancer undergoing treatment and then suddenly you have considerable weight loss, we refer to that as cachexia, people find that unattractive. The same with skin problems like acne. A lot of these signs of illnesses are considered to be unattractive. So that's why they get conflated. And also, more recently, we have the sort of fitness kind of conflation of health and beauty. And you see that a lot with advertisements of gyms. And they use the phrase, the healthy body is a beautiful body. So the way they market their services to make people fit is to actually subscribe or uphold narrow ideals of appearance. So usually when it comes to printed advertisement, you see this in posters a lot. There's a very typical and sort of homogenous image of what a healthy, fit person is. And that really contributes to our understanding that maybe unattractive features are actually pathological.
Right. So I can see how then you frame that as a passive practice. How does the pathologization of ugliness become an active practice?
This is really interesting because as an active practice, it's not super coherent. It's not cohesive. But I have found patterns on how cosmetic surgery as a practice have framed unattractive features or ugliness as a pathology. The first step is quite simple. They have started using the term aesthetic pathology. You will never see the term ugliness or unattractive. They use the term aesthetic pathology to describe features that are unattractive based on some ideals of beauty. And it's a very scientific sounding term, aesthetic pathology. The second is to start using terminology to make it sound more serious. So instead of using the term unattractive nose, people might start using the term defective. So defective nose or deformed nose. The third is to reframe cosmetic procedures no longer as enhancement, but therapeutic. So we start convincing patients or clients, and this is really an interesting, you might want to discuss this, the difference between a patient and a client in the context of cosmetic surgery. So they start framing their services as therapeutic or treatment rather than enhancement. And then the fourth one is really to overemphasize the supposed suffering that a person might experience if they have an unattractive feature or a feature that is considered an aesthetic pathology. And some practices have actually appropriated the languages from the social model of disability. So they talk about the concepts of exclusion, decreased opportunity, whether in education or employment, social isolation. And then to justify that unattractive features are serious concerns and why it merits to frame them as pathological.
On Radio National and the ABC Listen app, this is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and my guest this week is physician and philosopher Eve St. James Aquino, who's currently doing postdoctoral research at the University of Wollongong. We're talking about ugliness and the ways in which being less than conventionally attractive can become framed as a medical condition requiring medical intervention. This takes us into the area that you've described as aesthetic harms. You know, we're talking about some of the claims by which people legitimize pathologizing ugliness. Aesthetic harms, you know, this idea that people with features deemed unattractive can suffer various kinds of harm or disadvantage, and that therefore we are justified in framing ugliness in pathological terms. Tell me more about this notion of harm.
So harm is a very interesting philosophical concept, because how do we define harm? Is harm about pain? Is it about suffering? Or is harm something more social? It results in you being isolated or not being able to go to work. So that's an interesting concept in debates about how we should define disease. But the concept of harm is now being used or appropriated in the practice of pathologizing ugliness. So usually, again, using the social model of disability, people or practitioners have discussed that unattractive features lead to real social psychological harm. So it might lead to depression for them that could be harmful. But it could also lead to decreased opportunities or disadvantages in stages of life, like education or employment. And in so many ways, this is true, because we do recognize the phenomenon of halo effect. Halo effect is when someone has the advantage of being attractive and therefore becomes more successful in life. So usually attractive people have higher grades based on studies, or they get higher likelihood of employment and promotion. And the opposite of halo effect is the horn effect, because of the devil's horn. If you are unattractive, people say that you get lower grades, you don't appear to be as trustworthy as other people, or you're not as successful when it comes to employment and even relationships. And for other people, these are serious harms because of your physical appearance. And that is where the aesthetic harm is. The harm arising because you are deviating from some aesthetic standards.
Yeah, that's interesting, because it's close to this other category that you write about of ugliness as aesthetic dysfunction. Similar but a little different. What do you mean by aesthetic dysfunction?
Dysfunction is a concept that's usually something that naturalists appeal to. So it's deviating from a function, or it's a feature that makes the function perform less. So if you talk about any part of the body, for example, your ears, so the function of the ear would be to hear, to listen, and then that contributes to communication. If you have a dysfunction of the ear, it might be some blockage. So anything or any feature or any problem that stops you from hearing is considered to be a dysfunction. It's the same with teeth. It helps you masticate or chew on your food. So if there's pain or some mass happening in your mouth that stops you from chewing, that's a dysfunction. And in the context of pathologizing ugliness, people start referring to the function, biological function of survival and reproduction. So when we talk about disease, not talking about ugliness yet, any disease is something that results in dysfunction so that you are less likely to survive or less likely to reproduce. So if you have any kind of impairment, for example, high blood pressure, that might increase the likelihood of death, therefore decrease your survival. And because that happens, it will decrease the likelihood that you will reproduce. So that's a sort of biological definition of dysfunction. Some people are now claiming that unattractive features impacts on a person's survival because it might decrease their likelihood of employment, therefore decrease likelihood of having shelter and being able to sustain their living. But the other funny thing is that unattractive features supposedly compromises your ability to reproduce because you're less likely to find a sexual and a romantic partner and build a family. So that's where the aesthetic dysfunction lies. Unattractive features compromise your reproductive and survival functions.
This one worries me because on one hand, you know, there's a certain kind of logic to the idea that the way we look affects the success of our social interactions, and the success of our social interactions affects our reproductive success. That's fine. But there's something about the aesthetic dysfunction argument that makes me think of the way that incels talk about women and the whole business of relationships. Like, you know, if you're a 3, then you're never going to go out with a 10. You know, it's this sort of remorseless biological determinism. Is that how you see it?
Definitely. And I think pathologizing ugliness, especially in the concept of aesthetic dysfunction, it's really reductive. Number one, it reduces the way we interact with the world and the way we find relationships, whether it's friendships or romantic sexual relationships. It's often not just about one physical feature. Human beings have multiple dimensions. You have your voice, you have your personalities. Often it's not just about one thing. But when you talk about aesthetic dysfunction, it frames our social relationships and the way we sustain and build them as if it's just based on one thing, which is really not giving justice to what it means to be a human being. And also, exactly that, it also pushes this notion that there's only one way to live, which is to reproduce. And it's not. Some people choose to be single. And being single is not a pathology. Because first, if you follow that definition of health is about fulfilling or performing the function of survival and reproduction, then single people are pathological because they don't want to reproduce.
You also write about aesthetic deviation. This is another way that pathologizing ugliness becomes legitimized. And that's a really interesting one because here, like, we're talking about a norm, the establishment of an ideal appearance where deviations from that norm become seen as kind of gradations of ugliness. We see this sort of thing with apps that give you a score out of 10 for the shape of your face, of your facial attractiveness. And I just find that one so weird. I mean, the facial canon is so detailed and it's so specific. It's like there's a certain mathematical equation that we can use to calculate the ideal width of the nose. Where has all this come from? Do we go back to Renaissance art, or where do we find the roots of these aesthetic ideals?
It's really interesting when it comes to aesthetic deviation, and I think from aesthetic harm to aesthetic dysfunction, and now what I refer to as the third set of claims, which is aesthetic deviation. This is where things become more concrete. Because if you talk about dysfunction and harm, they're still a bit vague. They're not giving you exactly how to draw the line between an unattractive nose and an attractive nose. But when it comes to deviation, this is where numbers appear. So it's not just about saying, oh, that's a bit unsightly, that's the nose is a bit wide, or cheeks are a bit hollow. Here, when it comes to deviation, we start using numbers and average and proportion. People have referred to the golden ratio as a supposed guide for the ideal appearance, whether it's the face, the height, or the weight. And this has roots to Renaissance artists like Leonardo da Vinci with the Vitruvian Man. And those proportions are usually meant for sculpture and painting. It's a very Western, even at the time, very Italian standard of what a sculpted body or a marble body should look like. It was never meant to be a medical guide for appearance, but people have started saying that, oh, we have found the golden ratio. And golden ratio gives us an appearance of naturalism, that there is something that exists in the world, which is the ideal proportions of a face, for example, that is independent of human judgment. It will always exist, even if we like it or not. And of course, this is clearly untrue. There is no such thing as something that exists in the world in terms of ideal facial proportion. And this is quite challenging because medicine, if you talk about anatomy, it also upholds some average. So if you look at anatomy books, they provide numbers as well. That's why they can say when your eyes are too wide apart or when your eyes are too bulging. So the medicine itself contributes to numbers or specific averages when it comes to facial appearance. What cosmetic surgeons are doing is to really have, I guess, a strict and narrow average when it comes to proportion and measurements of the face. And if you deviate from these measurements, they start saying that this is a kind of impairment that requires surgery. But in terms of the basis of the golden ratio, so there's a mask that exists online and is being used in a lot of beauty apps. And they refer to the golden ratio mask. And supposedly the mask has these lines and it is supposed to be a guide for the proportion of your facial features. And what you do is you superimpose those masks or lines onto a facial image. And anything that deviates from the line is considered aesthetic deviation and therefore pathological. In my research, the golden mask developed by an American cosmetic surgeon, I was trying to find the supposed formula, the mathematical formula that came up with that mask. And I could not find any basis, any explanation, or even the formula, supposed formula, why you can get the mask as it is from golden ratio. So if you really investigate further, there's no basis for the golden ratio or for the idea that there is an objective measurement of facial beauty.
Eve St. James Aquino. He's a physician and postdoctoral research fellow at the Australian Centre for Health Engagement, Evidence and Values at the University of Wollongong. He's also the author of Pathologizing Ugliness, a conceptual analysis of the naturalist and normativist claims in aesthetic pathology. That was published last year in the Journal of Medicine and Philosophy, and we'll put a link on the Philosopher's Zone website. And this has been the first in a two-part mini-series of Philosopher's Zone episodes. In our next program, Eve is going to be talking with Kate Crawford, who's an author and researcher on media and artificial intelligence. They're going to be talking about beauty apps, which are designed to analyze and evaluate your facial appearance. And these days, beauty apps are using big data and AI to do their thing, and that's opened up a great big ethical can of worms. So don't miss the next episode of The Philosopher's Zone. It's going to be excellent. Until then, I'm David Rutledge. Bye for now.